countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
But first,
Boris Johnson and his Irish counterpart Leo Varadkar have said they can see a pathway to a possible Brexit deal.
Off to work. A private plane for the Irish leader. A speeding limousine for the Prime Minister.
The drama that is Brexit continues to swirl and swoosh in dizzying style.
Tucked away is a country house on the Wirral. A private moment of massive public importance. Could they shake on a deal?
From London to Liverpool, Belfast to Brussels, these past 48 hours has delivered even more changes to the plot. Observers observing a distinct change in what they're calling the mood music between Dublin and Downing Street.
I think it is possible for us to come to an agreement, to have a treaty agreed to allow the UK to leave the EU in an orderly fashion and to have that done by the end of October. But there is many a slip between cup and lip and lots of things that are not in my control.
In other words, it's not on, nor is it off.
I had a good conversation with the Irish Taoiseach Leo Varadkar yesterday, and I think both of us can see a pathway to a deal, but that doesn't mean it's a done deal.
All the while, on the ground, those most in the eye of a no-deal storm watch on in hope, if not helplessness. And all along the border, politics, history, business and farming are colliding to create an air of flux.
So, the British government has given way on Northern Ireland having different rules.
I've come here to Market Hill between Newry and Armagh.
That could mean the British government giving more ground, this time on customs being different here in Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK.
You know, that takes you directly into Southern Ireland then, you know.
10 miles north of the border, this is farming country.
If you drove that way, you would have a great difficulty knowing where the border actually is.
It's where Ivor Ferguson, president of the Ulster Farmers Union, runs a sheep and cereal enterprise. At one time, as a younger farmer, he was in the cattle trade too.
Well, when I was a young farmer, we used to fatten cattle, and we bought cattle in the south, you know, in Ballymahon and Ballinasloe and Roscommon and those sort of marts, you know. And
today, Ivor Ferguson, like all farmers north and south, along the border and from Donegal to Kerry, remain most at risk. A no deal would be catastrophic. A deal less so, but seismic nonetheless, according to farmers in the south. This is the view from north of the border.
But to go back to customs checks and all that, you know, it would be very difficult for us to operate here now in the farming, you know. For example, 30% of our milk travels south on a daily basis. Half of our lambs from Northern Ireland, well over 400,000 lambs a year, travel south. And of course, we have 8,000 or 9,000 pigs a week coming from the south to the north, you know. So we have got used to a system where, in effect, there is no border. And I mean, to go back to have checks and would be a problem. But the main issue, of course, wouldn't be the checks, it would be the tariffs. And for dairy farmers at the moment, you know, dairy farmers receive 24 pence a litre for milk. And make no mistake about it, dairy farmers are losing money at 24 pence. But to pay a 17 pence of a levy out of 24, you know, it just wouldn't work. So from that point of view, the checks wouldn't be an issue because we couldn't afford to go there anyway.
Farming, it seems, just carries on doing its own thing aside from politics up yes. around here. Is that true? Yes. Has that always been sort of the way?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, farming's a business like any other business. We have to get on with our business every day. And I have to say that the Ulster Farmers Union, as an organisation, we work very closely with our opposite numbers in the south, the IFA. And we try our best here as an organisation to keep politics out of our business. Mm. Because our main business is the viability of our small family farms. And we have to make sure that whatever deal is done, that it means that we can have a free and frictionless trade north-south and also east-west.
The Ulster Farmers Union will be very much a cross-community organisation, would it?
Oh, absolutely. We as an organisation, we have 11,500 members across Northern Ireland, and we have members right across. We're divided into 25 groups geographically spread across Northern Ireland, and as I say, we represent all farmers from Cross Midlane to Coleraine and back to Downpatrick, and I mean on all sizes of farms as well, where you have 5 cows or 500 cows, and also all sectors. So we are a broad church here in the Ulster Farmers Union. And we're very disappointed that we don't have an assembly here in Northern Ireland. We're very much on our own, and that's why it's so important that as an Ulster Farmers Union, at least we get a voice at Westminster, and more importantly at the moment we'll have a voice in Brussels as well. So from that point of view, I have to say we are disappointed that our politicians haven't come together and worked together, because at the end of the day, we as farmers, we all work together.
What sort of a Brexit do you actually support?
If I look back to October past, we took a position then to support Theresa May's deal. And even though there were one or two things maybe we weren't all that happy with, I would have to say that there was only, at that stage, there was only Theresa May's deal on the table, and the other one, alternative, was no deal. Everybody knew no deal was an absolute disaster for us going forward. So that's why we supported Theresa May's deal.
Which included the Northern Ireland only backstop, am I right?
That included the Northern Ireland only backstop. But more importantly for us, it allowed us to trade with our main market, which is the GB main market, at least 70%, and in some products like beef and pork, it could be 80%, goes to that market. The rest of it goes either to the Republic of Ireland or also to the other member states. So the Theresa May's deal allowed us to do that. If we were to stay in the customs union, you know, the Northern Ireland only deal that was proposed at the start, it would solve all our issues as farmers, but unfortunately it doesn't seem to be acceptable politically, you know. But for us to stay in the customs union would solve that border issue with tourists, and I nobody else has come up with a better plan yet. So I mean, we're very open minded. All we want to do as farmers in Northern Ireland is to get on with the work producing the food and be able to trade north-south free and frictionless trade, and trade with the GB market and the other member states in the EU. That's our main objective.
All-Ireland regulatory alignment when it comes to agri-food, is that something that you'd be supporting as well?
Oh yes, the All-Ireland regulatory alignment, I mean, it would do away with all the hassle with health certificates and veterinary certificates and all that sort of thing. It would do away with that, and that would be a big step forward.
Does all of this create a bit of a dilemma for, you know, unionist farmers, when on the one hand, being supportive of the union might actually be counterproductive from a farming perspective, and vice versa?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we as farmers, our main objectives here is to keep our farming profitable. And I mean, if some farmers feel that politics is very important to them, you know, that's all well and good. But we have to concentrate on keeping our farmers in business and having a viable farming business for our next generation.
Well, the final question I'm going to ask you is, October the 31st is looming. Would you prefer an extension rather than a no-deal crash out?
Well, the no-deal crash out is certainly something that nobody wants. You know, we just couldn't handle a no-deal crash out. I mean, whether there's another delay to the end of January, as some people talks about, you know, where that comes or not, if it does, we are just going to have to deal with the circumstances. But no matter what happens, anything's better than a no-deal.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Ivor, thank you very much indeed for chatting to us, and the very best of luck over the next few weeks and few months.
Thank you very much indeed, Damien. Thank you.
Yep, that's the president of the Ulster Farmers Union, Ivor Ferguson, speaking to me at his farm in County Armagh earlier, and with the talks going into the proverbial tunnel of secrecy over the coming days, and maybe thankfully so, the spin might stop, but of course the speculation will continue to swirl. Making it happen may well also be the battle cry of Brexiteers, but it is too the theme of this year's Women's Enterprise Day. It takes place next Thursday, 17th of October, and it's aimed at inspiring women to start and grow their own business. There are many ambassadors, including women like Vicky O'Toole, who's the managing director of JJ O'Toole, Ireland's oldest packaging company based in Raheen, County Limerick. And she'll be in Cavan on Thursday to tell her story of personal resilience in the face of adversity. Vicky never expected to be in business, as she's been explaining to Brenda Donoghue.
It's a really busy day today with all the containers coming in. Would you like to maybe go up to my office and like cup
have
of tea?
A cup of tea. Yeah. So, Vicky, we're in your office here. Obviously, we have some pictures from times gone by.
Yes. So, Brenda, in my office here, there is three photographs of three amazing gentlemen. They are the three previous generations of JJ O'Toole Limited. So starting off, there is John O'Toole, and he was the founder in 1914, followed by his son, Jack O'Toole, who was my late father-in-law, and then Fergus, who was the third generation, who's my late husband, who I think, actually, I have to say, looks like Richard Gere. So there are the three generations.
That's a very special photograph.
That's a really special photograph, and we have the exact same one at home.
So, Vicky, very impressive here. A lot to talk about. But the thing about you is you came to business really late in life. And I don't mean that that you were really old. But it wasn't expected.
No, it wasn't expected. It was totally unexpected.
So you were at home with five children, which is always busy and never easy. But did you have something inside you that said, you know, maybe...
Yes.
I really want to be in business.
I don't know if it was in business, but I certainly knew that there was something inside me that was kind of, you know, that wasn't content with being at home and looking after children, which is the most important thing. I was embarrassed, actually, sometimes to say to my friends, you know, that I kind of feel there's something else I would like to do as well as being a mum and a wife. You know, you get into a kind of a situation where you go with the flow then, and I started playing golf, and my mother-in-law actually said, you need to play golf, and I turned out to be quite good at it. And so that kind of was one day gone of the week. But there was always something in me, and Fergus and I were quite funny when we went out. He would lean towards listening to the women and I would lean towards listening to the men. I swear, it was desperate. You know, because I was interested in what they were saying. All my girlfriends at that point, none of them were working.
You were bringing up your children.
Yeah.
Had this little yearning to do something.
Yeah.
But really,
it was
that was life. And then Fergus got sick. Is that right?
Yeah, Fergus got sick. So our baby, my baby, who's 18, really, I have to stop, who's now in college, I need to stop calling him a baby. He was born 010101. And just out of the blue, and it very much was out of the blue, Fergus became unwell, you know, around that time. And he suffered from depression, and it was just a bolt out of the blue. It all came from a really big worry, you know, business and financial situations, and the plastic bag tax come in and things weren't going great. And he just felt, you know, under huge pressure, and it just was a horrible time. It really was a horrible time. And for me, I didn't realise, I didn't see it. And I think a lot of people who are living with it don't see it initially. Because you're living with that person every day. So I was hugely shocked by it all. And of course, Vicky being Vicky, thought I could fix it very quickly with Rescue Remedy and, you know, Camel Tea and walks and talking and all of that, but I couldn't fix it. He was quite sick then for 10 years before he died. What started off as me coming in emotionally to help him turned out for him spending more time at home, looking after the children. So he was at home more, I was here more, and then suddenly it was nearly a permanent situation without either of us realising it. But we were a kind of, is it a yin and a yang? We did it very well together. He was a better parent in that his patience was phenomenal compared to mine. To go back to your question 20 minutes ago, sorry, Brenda. I didn't think I'd end up here, but I would have liked to have done something, but probably not this route, probably a different route.
So because Fergus got sick and you ended up coming in here in a CEO role, I mean, did you feel that you were catapulted into it?
You know, I was coming in here and people didn't know why I was in here. I'm talking about clients, I'm talking about colleagues, I'm talking about suppliers. Fergus was here as MD. His father was here before that. A lot of them would have been here for both of them being here. It's no tool business, and suddenly here comes Vicky. And she doesn't obviously know anything about the business, which, fair, you know, they didn't say that, but, you know, it was a fair point.
What were the challenges for you?
There was so many things, Brenda. I mean, I wouldn't know where to start, really. Mm. There was the whole upset thing about you should be at work, Fergus, you know, leave her, go home and mind the kids. And that's what she's supposed to be doing. I mean, wasn't that long ago now? I remember my first board, my first sales meeting will never, to the day I die, I will never forget this. Ever. And it is what pushes me each time. The girls were, they were invited to a Debs. So they were having kind of, you know, the pre-Debs drinks.
Prinks.
I should know that with all my kids at this stage. Prinks. It was my first sales meeting and I was so nervous. And I remember sitting here thinking, I can't go in there, I can't. But anyway, long story short, I went in and it was fine. But by the time I got to the prinks had started. So I wasn't there for the watching the girls get dressed or anything like that. I walked in and a gentleman said to me, oh, God, you're a bit late, you know. And I said, yeah, I'm a bit late. You know, I've just had my first sales meeting. And in his words, because I will never forget it, what would you know about a sales meeting? Seriously. And unfortunately, Fergus overheard this because he was already there. And it was upsetting for him because then you get this whole, you know, look at this position I put her into. Mm. And whereas I was cross for him saying this. Anyway, look.
You got over your sales meeting.
Yes.
And then Fergus died.
Yes.
And that must have been, I can't imagine how tough that was on you and your family.
It was horrific. He died, just over 9 years ago. I was actually working that day and he died from depression and it was horrific and it was sudden and it's a life-changing moment and you never forget it. You get used to it, if you can say that. All the children are so successful for the moment and I actually, and I feel always will be, and I think it was because of Fergus. You know, there's only one parent and we all have to try really hard and we have to make up for, you know, him not being around.
So you were left then with five children.
Yeah.
And a business. Where were you in your head in terms of the business and trying to juggle a family and what happened? And I'm sorry you're getting upset.
Yeah, sorry. No, it's amazing. You get these waves that you're fine for years and suddenly somebody will say something to you and it'll pull a string.
Mm.
I suppose it just brings it all back. Where was I? I was selling the company. I mean, there was just no question about it. I mean, how could you possibly look after five children who'd lost their father so tragically and run a business at the same time? The day after Fergus's funeral, of course, we're all now feeling very desperately fragile and, you know, you just feel you're in a different world. My brother Mark, who's a great businessman, he's just been wonderful. He came over and, you know, I remember sitting at my dressing gown at the kitchen table thinking, Mark, that's it. You know, I couldn't possibly. And the best advice he gave me was wait for a month. See what happens. See how you feel in a month. And you know when people say to you, oh, you know, you'll be fine. You know, everything will get better. Like anybody who said that to me in the first year, I actually wanted to stab them. No, seriously, you feel like, particularly people who didn't know. You know, people who, I know how you feel. No, you don't know how I feel. Because I don't know how my children feel. And, you know, people that put themselves into your shoes when they've never been in those shoes. Mm. But anyway, slowly but surely, I give myself a target. I give myself a month with a month's mind. I challenged myself to get things done. And I got those done and then to go back to work and see how I felt. And I did go back. And my next challenge then was in a year to his anniversary when we had, you know, a big mass again to get all my things in order, you know. Obviously, that wasn't the most important thing. The most important thing is the support for the children. And we used to say to each other, if we only all had a bad day on the same day, it would be so much easier. You know, if it was a Monday, for instance, at 11 o'clock, where we all just had a complete meltdown. But that was the thing as well. The difficulty was everybody was feeling bad at different times or low at different times or scared at different times or hearing stupid things at different times.
How difficult a decision was it for you not to sell the company?
A couple of reasons. Well, what were we going to do with our colleagues? And their colleagues, they're not staff, they're colleagues. They've been here for years. Close the door or, you know, sell it. At that point, it was sell it. A lot of them would have lost their jobs. And most importantly, the name was going to go. So, look, we're not Dunn Stores or, you know, big, huge brands like that with a huge name. But we're the oldest packaging company in Ireland. And once JJ2 Limited name goes, it's gone. And also there's this part of you that you don't want to give up.
We're 9 years down the line and you're at the helm here. What have you done that has won you all these wonderful awards?
I don't know. I ask myself the same question. It's not the turnover. It's not the profit. It's not the margins. Everybody has told me this. It is the story. I suppose when you see somebody who was at home with five children, I think this must be it, and came in under, I suppose, difficult circumstances, had to learn the business from scratch, and then turn it around, I think, and not give up. I think that's it. Not giving up and persevering. I think that's why they give me awards.
Yeah, that's the remarkable Vicky O'Toole with Brenda Donoghue ahead of Women's Enterprise Day this Thursday. More details at localenterprise.ie. Speaking of enterprise, if you want to go to an organic farmers market, there is one happening in Marley Park in Dublin. It's been hosted by the IFA and it begins at 10 o'clock this morning. Lots of wonderful organic food produce on sale there in Marley Park. Do get along. Now, do you ever wonder where village and town names actually come from? Take the village of Clochjordan in Tipperary, for example. Any idea? Well, who knew? But doesn't it go all the way to the Middle East and indeed the Kingdom of Jordan? And as we speak, a group of 30 locals from Clochjordan are in Jordan, learning and leaving no stone unturned on an exploration mission to find out more about the connection between their home and the Arab Kingdom. It's in a few hours, the group will be arriving in Amman, the capital of Jordan. But before they left their base earlier this morning, I spoke to Greg Whelan, who's part of the group.
It goes back to a story in Clochjordan that one of the knights who lived locally went off on the Crusades in the 12th century and brought back a stone from the River Jordan from the baptismal site of Christ, and because he was a man of strong Christian convictions, having been out on the Crusades. So he used that as a foundation stone for his house in a place in Ireland, and then eventually it became known as Jordan Stone and Oscailge Clochjordain. And that's where the village came from. So we've kind of always had a little interest in this unique bit of Jordan sitting in Ireland. And a number of years ago, as part of the Community Development Committee, a number of us kind of came up with the idea of, let's see, can we either locate the stone in the house or get another one?
And then
so we set off doing that, to organise getting a stone from Jordan to Clochjordan.
And how did that come about? How did you go about getting a piece of stone from Jordan back to Clochjordan?
Well, we got in contact with Jordan's consul in Ireland, Mr. Joe Gagan. He put us in touch with the Irish consul here in Jordan, Ramsay Curry. It was just before the Irish embassy opened up. So Ramsay was looking after Irish interests here. And he, through the Jordanian Irish Association, sourced the stone for us. He then kindly dropped that to Beirut, where the government jet had just dropped the Minister for Foreign Affairs. And the Minister kindly brought actually two stones back to us in Clochjordan. What we did was we had a handover ceremony. The consul came over from Jordan and a number of other Jordanian dignitaries. So we had a lovely ceremony this time last year. And we then decided to mount one of the stones as a civic art piece. And that was, we had the unveiling of that just the week before we came away. So that stands now as a piece of public art in the village of Clochjordan, serving as a more permanent, visible link between Jordan and Clochjordan.
And I presume that is where the seeds were sown for this visit. Will you tell me more about the visit, how it came about, and who's there with you?
It's a cross-section of people from around Clochjordan itself and the neighbouring parishes. We have people who are involved in tourism business in Clochjordan and around it, people from the farming community, local businesses, a good cross-section of people who had an interest in the story and in seeing Jordan.
And what have you seen in Jordan over the past few days? Has it been a busy schedule?
It's been a quite hectic schedule. We're very fortunate that when we approached the consul to get a recommendation who to use as our in-country representative, he found us an Irish Jordanian family who run their own tour company here, Tanya Tours. They've been at it for 30 years. And Elizabeth Casey, who's from Dublin, it's herself and her husband and her family now. And they've been wonderful getting us into particular sites such as Petra at just the right times of day. And, the wonder and the awe. Petra is one of the seven wonders of the world. And you can see why. How man was able to produce such art with such rudimentary tools thousands of years ago. Fantastic sites. And the natural wonders then of the Dead Sea and of the Wadi Rum where we camped out the other night. Beautiful scenery, and then just the awe and beauty of what man was producing thousands of years ago.
Okay, sounds fascinating, and it is a great tourist attraction out there. You are nestled between Syria to the north, Saudi Arabia to the southeast, Israel then, and Palestine over to the west. So it's a relatively stable part of the Middle East, and it sounds fascinating indeed. You mentioned there that there are a number of locals, and I do believe that Ger Darcy, who's well well known locally in political circles, but also in farming circles, is with you there. Ger, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Damien.
How are you keeping?
I'm very good, very good. Enjoyed my trip here in Jordan. Most interesting, quite different from the country I've left behind, which I believe it's pouring rain at the moment. Here in Jordan, their biggest problem in the rural communities, or indeed anywhere in the country, is the lack of water. It's the second, I believe, driest country in the world.
You are a farmer. You're farming with your son, who I believe is back home, looking after everything, listening to you out there in the heat of the desert. Has it made you appreciate the work involved in other hotter climes when it comes to harvesting food? Or do they harvest anything out there? Are they able to?
Well, I'm amazed at what they're able to achieve. They have only about 8% of their land is arable and fertile. And what they're able to grow there is amazing. But anywhere they have groundwater for irrigation, to grow fantastic fruits and vegetables. Otherwise, then, where the nomadic people that are roaming the desert seeking out green areas for their animals, for the sheep and goats in particular, donkeys, we wonder, sometimes in Ireland, we talk about our grass management. Out here, it's amazing what they're able to do with the tiny little bits of vegetation that they have here and there through the desert.
I know that everybody in Clough Jordan is now very well aware of their connections with the Kingdom of Jordan. Are they aware out there of Clough Jordan?
Well, they are now, and they're making every effort to make the connection. They're doing their best to develop a tourism industry here. It's developed to a certain extent, and they have the hotels and that in the larger centres and that, and obviously they have, as Greg mentioned earlier on, they have the ancient sites which attract an awful lot of tourists. This is something I think that, you know, would have huge potential for them, because I suppose in Ireland as well, we pride ourselves on our ancient monastic sites, ecclesiastical sites and historical areas, and they have them here as well.
Okay, and Greg, just finally back to you. What do you think can be achieved from this visit? How can you build on this visit this week?
Well, one of the things we did during the week was we had a meeting with the chairman of the Jordanian Tourist Board, and then with the Jordanian Irish Association and the Irish Embassy. We're meeting up with them for a function tomorrow evening. So it's to kind of create links that, you know, we could possibly see, you know, tourism from Jordan to Ireland and vice versa, and of course vice versa. It's important, you know these sites, you know, need to be protected, and they need tourism dollars to protect them, which are a gift to the world and not just Jordan.
All right. Well, as the song goes, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's certainly a long way from Clough Jordan to Jordan. And you're coming near the end of your adventure out there. Enjoy the last 24 hours or so. And thank you very much for joining us. And safe trip home to you both, Greg and Ger.
Thanks very much, Damien.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that was Greg Whelan and Councillor Ger Darcy from Clough Jordan, who are on that maiden visit to Jordan. By the way, the group funded their own trip there and they'll return home to Tipperary tomorrow. Now, this month, RTE Radio 1's much-loved programme, Sunday Miscellany, continues its 50th birthday celebrations with the publication of Miscellany 50. This beautiful little book is a collection of specially commissioned essays to recall and reflect life in Ireland over the past 5 decades. Now, to mark the publication of Miscellany 50, Donal Hayes read his essay recalling this particularly Irish rite of passage, a first trip to the Gaeltacht, as it happened to him in 1978 for an audience at Dublin's Project Arts Centre.
The flirting came as a surprise as we linked up for the Siege of Ennis. Dancing, weaving, moving in time since time began, eyes and smiles and hearts locked, sunlit shafts in the warm August Irish college evening. Later we kissed, my first ever kiss at 14. My summer of love in Ballingeary in 1978 had started off quite bleakly. The rain was incessant, constantly whispering all day, and the nights sounding only of water. I was billeted with a different Bannon tea than my friends, and it did not suit. 17 of us queued up at the door of Bannihoolawine on Cade Law, and as I looked at the modest house, I couldn't believe there were sufficient bedrooms for us all. There wasn't. The O'Sullivan family, four poshty plus Mr and Mrs, gamely packed into one bedroom, and the 17 Buccalee were bunked down in bedrooms and corridors and living rooms. As the month of August progressed, the damp house ripened in sympathy with the hedgerows, and a deep, earthy, mushroomy, wet-leaved smell pervaded all. Catering was a spectacular affair. Not so much for the quality, which was shocking, but for the sheer volume of food Banny Hulawine generated from her limited stretch of formica. She could produce 30 slices of warm toast at the same time from a two-slice toaster. An apparently small pot steamed scores of freshly dug praw tea to stomach-popping perfection. Pounds of blistering sausages all came from the one pan. There was little to entertain in Ballingeary. Every day there was a cycle to Gugganbarra, and every evening a football match or a ceilidh in the hall. Curtains would be closed, but spotlights of evening sunlight picked out the dancing dust. Emer had spoken to me for the first time late in the month. The cycle to Gugan took the most beautiful twisting route to the wellspring of the River Lee. It was hard to reconcile this river with the angry torrent that it grew to by the time it reached the Mardyke and Cork. I was at the back of the group when I realised someone was cycling beside me. "Hey, careful, don't crash into me." "I'm sorry, I didn't see you," I apologised, even though I was nowhere near her. "Are you from here?" Her accent was clearly Dublin, one of the girls staying up at Benny Varacuz. "God, no, you must be kidding. I'm from Cork." "This is Cork, you culty." "No way. Cork is the city. This is just the country. This is like Kerry." Emer was poking fun at me and continued to do so for the rest of the day. I was having the most fun of all that I had all summer, and it was with a girl. My head was in a whirl. She was slightly taller than me, but managed to look petite. She had the most beautiful eyes, and she was laughing at everything I said. I was not stupid. I knew straight away that we were in love. I would need to tell my parents and move to Dublin. That night was the last dance, or Cailí Mór as it was called. All the Muntóri, all the families, and all the students would be there for one final knees up. The best local band would play. The whole building shook as the eight musicians on the stage launched into Ballylimnee. Couples facing couples, advancing and retiring, crossing over, crossing back, all the time holding hands. I saw Emer down the hall and tried to manoeuvre down towards her, but the military precision of the dance forbade it. Between the dances, I was gone. Making my way down the hall through the rakes of Mallow, the bridges of Athlone, the humours of Bandon. I thought I had lost her, but she appeared by my side right in time for the Siege of Ennis. No one else existed. We laughed and danced, drew close and pulled away. There was sidestepping and ducking through arches, and we held hands like we would never let go. As the siege ended, our momentum kept us going, and we ended up outside in the warm evening air. When we kissed, my life changed. It was the single most beautiful, most delicate, most personal thing that had ever happened to me. Kesht, what happened to my first love? Fragra. She is married in Perth, is still beautiful, and every St. Patrick's Day in the club, when they play the Siege of Ennis, she has to step outside. She closes her eyes and runs her finger through your soft curls and kisses your milky breath one more gentle time.
Donal Hayes and more of Sunday Miscellany at 9:10 tomorrow. Suzanne Campbell, good morning to you.
Good morning.
The hearings are going on over in Brussels to appoint the new commissioners. Phil Hogan, as we know, is going to trade. He had a fairly good interview in front of the MEPs. But what of the his successor? He's the Polish nominee. His name is Janusz Wojciechowski.
That's it. He was a Polish MEP. Poland got the nod, basically, to put forward a commissioner in this role. And it's all very political, as you know. I think they put forward a couple of people that were turned down initially. And he's now the man looking most likely to take the role. But he had to go through, first of all, a hearing earlier in the week, which he wasn't very impressive at all. He spoke in English. It was very vague, very low on detail. The MEPs asked him questions about his policies. And the view afterwards was, gosh, he's absolutely terrible. deplorable, really universally around Brussels and also here in Ireland, of people looking on, because you can watch these hearings online.
Right.
I was there for his second hearing on Wednesday. He was a little bit better. He spoke in his native language. He was a bit more fluid. But he was still full of general statements about protecting European farmers, stuff you can read anywhere, without any mechanisms or particular policies to put in place around what we know so well are the problems. So it was still just very, very vague. So there was still an awful lot, really, an awful lot of people left quite unimpressed with him. One of them was Matt Carty, MEP for Midlands North West, because look at what he's facing, you know, a declining EU budget, action on climate change and farming, full prices. So I spoke to Matt Carty after the second hearing.
I'm really surprised by how ill-prepared the Commissioner-designate appeared when he came before committees, not only in his original hearing, which may be at some level excusable, but for him to come back and again offer no detail, no specifics, essentially adopting no position on any of the key issues that were before the committee and that are going to be facing him as Commissioner. So it was more surprise as well as disappointment, because we are going to be seeing, as we know, a crucial period for agriculture. We are, thanks to the last commissioner, now facing a reduced cap budget, the threat of Mercosur, when we combine that with the challenges that Brexit's undoubtedly going to present, and the whole issue of climate action that required. This is going to be a big defining period for European agriculture. It's going to be defining, of course, for Irish family farmers. And we would have hoped at least that we would have a commissioner who had a starting position on some of the big issues that those farmers are going to face.
Is it a little, though, that we had Phil Hogan in that seat for years? People had access to him. This is a Polish man. He wasn't as strong going into the role.
Well, the one thing nobody can accuse Phil Hogan on is not having a position on matters. From my perspective, the problem with Phil Hogan is that the position he adopted on the key issues was the wrong one. So I don't buy into the argument that Phil Hogan was a good commissioner for Irish farmers. He was the commissioner who gave the seal of approval to the Mercosur trade deal. He endorsed an EU budget. He failed to tackle what I would consider to be key issues, such as unfair trading practices. But notwithstanding that, his successor appears to be someone who doesn't have a position on anything at the moment. So some people can look at that in different ways. Do we have a blank sheet that perhaps if we can make and present the logical arguments in favour of measures that support our family farmers, is he going to be open, or is he a stalking horse for perhaps the intensification agenda that we know, of course, that some within the European Commission do pursue?
As well as the hearings for the Ag Commissioner, of course, in Brussels this week, it was also the week of the Committee for the Regions and Cities. So members from all over the European Union were gathered to debate issues. And one of the members is Leitrim councillor and farmer Enda Stenson. He's really worried about the position for small farmers under the next round of EU policy, which is 2021 to 2027. He's a big fan of Phil Hogan, despite the Mercosur agreement, and he's not a fan, as you'll hear, of the new Commissioner.
I don't think he's Commissioner for Agriculture that has a lead on his brief. Now, Phil Hogan was absolutely hands-on. Ireland probably got more money than we had ever received before under Phil Hogan. We were lucky in that aspect. I am greatly afraid, and I know that the second interview for this new Commissioner was today. There is a lot of question marks. I don't know if they will be answered in those interviews, and I'm sad to think that they won't be answered until he is in place and putting his agenda forward, and that is probably, for a country like Ireland, maybe too late for anybody to intervene at that stage. I don't think he was very definite on anything. I wanted from the new Commissioner, say, a level playing field where each farmer was supported, not just the bigger feedlots, the bigger farmers. You know, and we have suffered that the bigger got more and the smaller got less.
Especially with suckler farmers like yourself in a very bad place.
Absolutely. Well, the suckler farmer is not now, and we have seen the whole beefland movement, and we have seen the anger that has been at the factory gates by farmers. It's a lot of those farmers, they cannot make ends meet.
Well, then, if you take CAP aside because it's a supporting system which isn't making money, is it more up to individual governments in individual countries to look at fairness and competition in the marketplace, supermarkets, retailers, and all of that, which we're not really attacking in this?
Absolutely. It's up to central governments to make a decision. The money will come. The government knows well where the percentages of the funds are going, and they're not going to the weaker people at the bottom.
In terms of farm payments?
In terms of farmer payments. payments. And if the farm payments don't come directly to those farmers that are keeping this going, the suckler herd will die. If the suckler herd dies, the beef herd will die along with it. What is that going to do to the country?
Problems with Irish farming, though, when I meet colleagues in Europe, the same sort of problems are replicated in other countries too, Suzanne.
Absolutely. There's 400,000 European farms closing every year. In fact, per hour, as this programme goes out, 30 farmers will have left the business. We also have a huge challenge of emissions from agriculture. And on Wednesday evening, actually, in Brussels, there was a really important hearing from the new Commissioner, Frans Timmermans, on the Green New Deal, which is going to be an enormous thing. It proposes an awful lot of actions on climate and environment insofar as it could supersede or how it's going to complement farm policy is not even clear at this point. I asked Liam McHale of the IFA and COPA, the European Farm Union in Brussels, what he and the other farm organisations there think of Wojciechowski and the period ahead.
Going forward, we need a strong person in the role. He will have to fight around the College of Commissioners, around the table of the other 27 commissioners to satisfy the demands of farmers and agriculture. And that's where we need a strong person. And, you know, we've enjoyed that for the last 5 years with Commissioner Hogan. And, you know, ideally we would like that strength of negotiation around the table to achieve what agriculture needs, particularly as we now this evening will hear Mr. Timmermans talk about the Green Deal. And we'll want to see, well, how will that impact on the CAP? What will be the climate obligations that the new Commission is setting out for farmers over and above what may have been within the CAP proposal as presented by Commissioner Hogan?
He's also very passionate. He spoke about farmers across the European Union. 400,000 European farms are closing every year. In 1 hour, 30 farmers will leave the business of farming.
He was very strong on generation renewal. We know that the average age of farmers across Europe is 57, 58 years of age, and that needs to be addressed. The challenging conditions we've seen within the suckler sector in Ireland, they've been mirrored actually across Europe. In speaking to the other farming associations here, whether it's Italy, Spain, Poland, France, and most recently we saw protests in the Netherlands, there's huge unrest. The return is not coming back to the farmer, whether that's through unfair trading practices, structure of the industry, lack of transparency. You know, we're hoping that going forward there will be additional support there, because as has been pointed out by the Commissioner Designate today, these farmers are very often in the most rural, far removed parts of the European Union from where we are today in Brussels. I was at the trade fair yesterday in Enuga in Cologne, and the feedback there from the Irish processors is there is huge pressure coming on imports now from South America. There's Argentinian beef coming in at, for some of the prime steak cuts, up to €4 a kilo cheaper than the most competitive Irish price.
That's even before Mercosur, or more comes available onto the marketplace.
That's before Mercosur, that's in the current environment of Brexit, and you know, even the Christmas trade, we're not looking at a huge lift in that according to what the market is telling us.
That's Liam McHale there, the IFA man in Brussels, talking to you, Suzanne. I'm going to let you go now because your 9 neighbours are out sitting in the car waiting to get a lift home to Rural County. So you better go. Playback's up after 9. Good luck.